We interrupt your regularly scheduled podcast to bring you Listen, Watch, Discuss. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to Listen, Watch, Discuss. As always, I'm your host, Brent Aiken. And on tonight's episode, it is the Season 7 finale, which means of course, if you've been listening to the podcast, every season finale that falls at the end of the year, of every year, that marks the time that I do my top 10 favorite movies of 2023 episode. So, 2023 was for a lot of people, a mixed bag when it came to movies. There were some really good movies that, you know, were box office successes, and then there were a bunch of movies that people either thought were okay or people thought were terrible, and they didn't make nearly what the studios thought they would make. There were a good amount of, in my opinion, good movies, and there were definitely enough movies, good movies, to make a top 10 list. Now, I didn't end up seeing every movie that I intended on seeing that was on my list. However, I did see more than 10. I saw at least 10 or more than 10. I believe I saw 16, 17. Which was maybe about half of my list of movies that I wanted to see. So, I saw enough to justify making a top 10 episode. And I have some, I was thinking about it earlier today, and I'm confident in where I have everything placed. And I think it's a good list. So, I guess we'll start off with number 10. Number 10 being, of course, Thanksgiving. Now, I reviewed this a month ago, back in November, and basically Thanksgiving, and also, before I go forward, I'd like to mention that I may be going into some slight spoilers regarding the movies that I'm going to be discussing in the ranking list. So if you have not seen any of these movies, when I get to a certain movie, and you don't want to be spoiled on anything that happens, just pause the episode and come back to it when you've seen said movie. So, with that being said, Thanksgiving is a horror movie from director Eli Roth, and it's based on a story that he produced with Roger Birnbaum. And in my review, my podcast episode, my episode when I reviewed the movie, I mentioned that this was based on Eli Roth's fictitious trailer of the same name from the Grindhouse, the 2007 movie, which was a double length, like a double feature, where it was Robert Rodriguez's Planet Terror and Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, like back to back. And it is the third of the fake trailers that preceded those two movies to be made into an actual movie. The other two, of course, being Robert Rodriguez's Machete, which also got a sequel, and Jason Eisner's Hobo with a Shotgun. And Machete Kills, the sequel to that, both came out in 2010 and 2013, and then Hobo with a Shotgun came out in 2011. Now, I haven't seen either of those, but maybe they're as good as this, who knows. But yeah, this movie, basically, if you haven't seen the trailer, or if you haven't seen the fake trailer that came out when the fake trailer that came out before Grindhouse, or if you haven't seen the trailer for this movie or the movie itself, it's basically about this Black Friday incident gone terribly wrong in 2022. And then the following year, someone in the town decides to dress up as one of the founding pilgrims, John Carver, and run around murdering the people that were responsible for causing chaos during the Black Friday event. And a group, as typical with slasher movies, a group of plucky young high school teens, sophomore or junior year aged high school teenagers, decide to take it upon themselves to track down this John Carver-inspired serial killer and stop him before he, you know, pretty much kills everyone that was at the Black Friday Rite Mart catastrophe, because pretty much the entire town was there. And I really liked the movie. I thought it was pretty good. The kills were great. There's some great practical effects with the kills, and they were very creative. I love that the trailer didn't really give away every kill and whatever they showed, they kind of, you know, it wasn't really like, if they showed a kill, they didn't show the entire kill. So when I got to a scene that I thought, oh, okay, well, this kill was in the trailer, there was more to it. So I loved that, you know, the kill that I thought was going to happen, it played out a little differently. There was more to that scene. The acting from everyone was pretty good, especially the main character, the main girl, Addison Rae, she was good, Gabby, but the main girl, Neil Verlack, I believe I'm pronouncing her name right, as Jessica, she was great. Patrick Dempsey was great as the sheriff, Eric Newton, or Newland, sorry, who, if you remember, he was the Detective Kincaid in Scream 3, which is very appropriate considering this movie does remind me of Scream in a lot of ways, where it's a small town, a group of like 5 or 6 teenage friends decide to band together to figure out who this masked serial killer is that's running around their town and killing people. And it somehow connects back to them, and it's a mystery on who the killer is, you know. But that being said, it's not, I wouldn't call it a Scream ripoff. It's just very similar to Scream. And yeah, I liked, and some people said that they saw the twist coming as to who the killer was. I didn't, but thinking back on it, it makes sense. But still, I mean, I didn't quite see it coming, but like it added up. Like it made sense who the particular killer, who the killer was. And yeah, I thought it was well directed, well shot. The kills were great. I guess that's pretty much it. And it's nice to have a Thanksgiving-themed horror movie because, you know, Halloween obviously is the king when it comes to horror movies based around Halloween. Or, you know, there, even if a horror movie isn't based on Halloween, people love to watch horror movies on Halloween. And then, of course, you do have Christmas horror movies, but there aren't really that many mainstream Thanksgiving movies that are horror movies. So I do like that this is kind of one of the first. Well, I mean, there have been some, like, Thanksgiving horror movies, but none that were, like, mainstream blockbusters like this, to this level. So I do love that we have one now, which is kind of neat. And it was pretty good. And the acting was great. So I'm looking forward to watching this again next year. And it did pretty well. It grossed $45.9 million worldwide against a budget of $15 million. And they've confirmed that a sequel is in development. So I'm curious to see what they do next. Will it be the same person who is the killer in the second one that it was? Will it be the same person that was the killer in this one, in the second one? Or will it be someone else? Who knows? But this is number 10 for a reason. It was good. Just there were some more on the list that I thought deserved to be a little bit higher. So, and now let's move on to number 9. At number 9, we have Megan. Now, Megan, when it came out, was a huge surprise, I'd say, caught most people off guard with in terms of how good it was compared to the trailers. Because not that the trailers made it look bad, it just, people assumed it would be more campy and cliche, maybe more of a, just of a worse movie than it was. But it was actually pretty decent, and it was, And it was a little campy with the horror, and it didn't quite go too hard with the horror. Like, it wasn't too gory or bloody, but there were some, and some of the kills were off screen, a good amount of the kills were off screen, but it still was creepy in how they played it. And, the movie, I really loved it a lot. I thought it was a good horror movie. And if you don't know, the movie came out, it was produced by Blumhouse Pictures, it was released by Blumhouse Pictures, but Universal Pictures released it, and Blumhouse was involved too. They were another production company involved with it. And basically the plot is about this 8-year-old girl, Katie, whose parents are killed in a car accident, and she's sent to live with her Aunt Gemma, played by Allison Williams. Yeah, played by Allison Williams. And she, she doesn't have kids. She is trying to figure out how to go about being a good guardian and caretaker and aunt to her niece. And she decides to, because she's a roboticist and she works at this high tech toy company, Funky, in Seattle. She decides to give her this prototype robot that they're hoping to release to the market called Megan. And she basically is like a 8-9-year-old lifelike robotic girl. And she's basically there to be supportive and a friend to whoever, you know, she's programmed to be friends with. And, you know, since she is, since one of her creators was Gemma, she programs her to be friends with Katie. And of course, you know, things start off well at first, but then things take a turn when Megan starts to, you know, develop more, and grow more, of her own. She becomes more aware of her surroundings. You know, her artificial intelligence is growing, and she, you know, starts to see Gemma as a threat to Katie, because she is starting to, she's like, I don't like the way you're treating her. You're putting too many boundaries on her. And it gets to a point where Megan is becoming more of a guardian or parent to Katie than Gemma is. And then, you know, they have to stop Megan before she, you know, kills everyone that she deems a threat to Katie, including Gemma. And yeah, I really liked the movie, and a lot of people liked it too. When that first trailer came out in, I want to say it was like October. Yeah, I believe it was like October of 2022. When that trailer came out, everyone was like, this looks like it might be, you know, everyone's like, this could go one of two ways. It could be so good, it's bad. Like, it could be good, decent. It could be good, or at the very least decent, or it could be so bad it's good, you know? And I think most people would agree that it's at least good, you know? It's not great, but it's pretty good. And the acting from everyone's pretty good, too. The girl who plays Katie, who I believe is Violet McGraw, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, Violet McGraw. She does a really good job for a child actress. I mean, and that's not a diss. I'm just saying, like, for her being a child, she is a great actress. Allison Williams does a great job as her Aunt Gemma. And the girl who plays Megan does a fantastic job too. And it was like, it's part special effects, like it's part practical effects and part, like, I believe some of it's like practical effects, and but it's actually like a girl in the costume, or a girl in like the dress and the leggings and the shoes, but they have like this like plastic, like rubbery plastic face over the actress who plays her, so it's like it's not her face. It's funny because like Megan, they do a good job at making her seem like very sweet and innocent, but then when you see her, it's like, yeah, but you do, there's something off about you. Like, the voice is just too nice, and her movements are too lifelike, and the way she blinks, and just everything about her seems just a little off, no matter how nice she's being to Katie or Gemma. And the longer the movie goes on, the more we start to see her rack up a body count. She's like, hey, anyone who messes with my girl, anyone who messes with my friend, got to answer to me. And, you know, it gets, like I said, it gets to the point where Gemma has to, you know, stop her before it's too late, before she, you know, tries to destroy the entire world, tries to kill everyone who's a threat to her or Katie. And yeah, Amy, I believe I'm pronouncing it right. Amy Donald is the girl who plays Megan. And Jenna Davis does the voice of Megan. Okay. So, yeah. So she does the actual physical movements for the physical portrayal of Megan. And then Jenna does the voice. They both did a great job. And yeah, everyone else who I didn't mention by name were great. And yeah, the movie did great. Its budget was $12 million and it grossed $181 million at the box office. And of course, with it grossing that much, and Blumhouse tends to make their movies on a cheap budget. Jason Blum tends to make his movies cheaper, so that way they have more of a chance of grossing more money at the box office, which, you know, smart business move. I appreciate that. And it makes sense. So naturally, with it being that low of a budget and it grossing that much, naturally, planning on releasing a sequel, which is appropriately titled Megan 2.0, and it's supposed to come out not this upcoming January, but January 17th of 2025. So I'm looking forward to it. I am curious to see what they do with a second one, because they kind of do set it up to where at the end it's like, oh, Megan isn't actually dead. She transferred her, well, not consciousness because she's a robot, but she transferred her, she like downloaded, you know, transferred her thoughts and everything to another robot, like to an Alexa or something that was in Katie and Gemma's house. So, you know, naturally it's like, oh, well, okay, so she's not dead. She's going to jump to, she's going to make herself a new body, maybe. But yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of different things you could do with a sequel. And yeah, I just loved the sci-fi, horror, the science fiction and horror elements mingling together in the movie. I thought it was neat how they blended the two genres. So, good movie. Looking forward to the sequel. And with that being said, let's move on to number 8. At number 8, we have Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's latest movie, his 12th movie overall, and it was pretty good as well. It was released on July 21st, 2023, and it is about J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist who was basically the father of the atomic bomb, and the Manhattan Project, which is the name of the project that he oversaw, was basically him and a team of other scientists and soldiers in the army, military, basically coming together to build this atomic bomb and to strike back at the Japanese. The bomb would eventually be dropped on after, you know, not too long after completion, the bomb would be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki also, I believe. It was dropped on Hiroshima, but Nagasaki also got some of the effects from the radiation from the bomb. But yeah, so I thought this movie was pretty good, and overall of all of Christopher Nolan's movies, I'd say it's in my top half. Because I ranked all of his movies earlier this year, back in season 6, before I went to see Oppenheimer. And after seeing Oppenheimer, I would probably place this in the top half of his movies, like the first, somewhere within the top 6. And the acting, as with most Christopher Nolan movies, is top-notch. It's got a stacked cast. A lot of people, some people who only have like two or three scenes, but the scenes they're in, they do a good job with what little they have. The lead character, J. Robert Oppenheimer, is played by Cillian Murphy, who, if you have seen any of Christopher Nolan's movies before, he played Scarecrow in the Dark Knight trilogy. He did a great job there. And he also is Thomas Shelby in the series Peaky Blinders, which I have just started. I started that yesterday. I saw the first episode. It was pretty good. But he does a great job as the titular character. Emily Blunt plays his wife, Kitty, Catherine, does a pretty good job too. Matt Damon is the general who's the director of the Manhattan Project. He plays Leslie Groves, a United States Army Corps of Engineers officer. I could go on about the cast, but you've got Robert Downey Jr. as Rear Admiral Lewis Strauss. He's a retired naval officer, and he does a great job. There's a lot of scenes where he gets... he's chewing the scenery, and he gets a lot of scenes where he's like espousing dialogue, like a lot of scenes where he's just talking, and you can just tell like he's chewing the scenery up. Florence Pugh, one of my celebrity crushes, she doesn't have a whole lot to do in the movie, but her role and what, you know, the scene she has with Cillian Murphy, I liked. I thought they were pretty good. I would have liked for her to have had a little more screen time, but she was good with what she had, and from everything I've seen her in, she's great in everything else too. But yeah, she plays Jean Tatlock. She's a psychiatrist, and she eventually becomes Oppenheimer's romantic interest. But yeah, I mean, Casey Affleck's in the movie, Rami Malek, Kenneth Branagh, James Darcy, Josh Peck is in the movie. Like, yeah, I could keep going, but yeah, there's, I think Gary Oldman. Yeah, Gary Oldman plays the president, the 33rd president, Harry S. Truman, and he was the one who decided to go through with dropping the two atomic bombs. Okay, yeah, my bad. They dropped one on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki. But yeah, so yeah, he was the one who made the decision to drop the bombs on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And yeah, he has one scene with I believe it's just one scene, but he has at least one scene with Oppenheimer, and just the scene, he just basically tells him off. He's like, quit being a baby. Let me do my job. You did a good thing for the country. Stop crying about, you know, losing all those Japanese people. Because, like, Oppenheimer's trying to tell him, look, I don't feel that comfortable with what I created. I created this world-destroying weapon. And then he just tells him to quit crying and get back to work. Get back to work, essentially. And I was like, okay, damn, it's a little harsh. And Oppenheimer just, like, kind of just, I mean, he doesn't shrug it off, but he just kind of just, like, gets up and leaves. He's like, well, that could have gone better. But yeah, so the movie was great. I mean, the acting was great. I feel like it could have maybe been a little shorter, because it's like right at 3 hours. I don't know what you would have cut out, but I mean, that's like really my only criticism or nitpick, is that it could have maybe been a little shorter, but I don't know what could have been cut out. But I mean, but overall it was great. I mean, the acting was great. I loved the way it ended, the conversation with Oppenheimer and Einstein. And the guy, I forgot the guy's name, but the guy who played Einstein in the couple scenes he had was really good too. And yeah, the budget was $100 million. It almost grossed a billion. It got to like $955.2 million. So it was pretty close. It didn't quite reach it, but it was close enough. And yeah, I if you're a Christopher Nolan fan, I feel like you'll love the movie. And the movie, it also helped a lot too, the fact that it was released on the same day as Barbie, because this and Barbie both had the same were both released on the same day, and people, you know, it just blew up on social media. Like the advertisement pretty much, you know, that pretty much was it advertised both movies in and of themselves, like just the advertising for that everyone did on social media for the movies. Because they were like, oh, hey, Barbenheimer, you know, the big Barbenheimer double features. Like, which one are you going to go see? You're going to go see both? People were debating, you know, which one was going to make more money. And Barbie was the one that ended up making more, but Oppenheimer was not too far behind. And I feel like both movies kind of propped each other up, because everyone was debating whether or not they were going to go see, which one they were going to go see, or if they were going to go see both. And yeah, it was just a huge event. And I kind of love that, that, you know, because usually it's like, oh, well, if two big movies are coming out on the same weekend, one's going to do way better than the other. But I do love how they both, like I said, propped each other up, and both did almost made about as much money. So, but yeah, if you haven't seen it, watch it. And obviously I'm recommending all these movies because they're my top 10. But if you haven't seen it, watch it. If you're a fan of Christopher Nolan, I feel like you'll love this movie as well. And now, let's move on to number 7. At number 7, we have John Wick, Chapter 4. Now, this was a movie I had been looking forward to for almost four years. I had not had the pleasure of seeing the John Wick movies before, like, as they were being released. I ended up seeing them after the third one came out. It was the Christmas break of 2019. I believe it was like maybe the 29th or 30th. But I managed to see, I bought the first three movies and watched them all over Christmas break of 2019 when I was off from work, I believe, or I guess it was college. No, it was college, yeah. I was on Christmas break from college. And or maybe I was working too. Well, anyway, but I was off for a week, or I had some time off. It was some time, I believe I was off for like a week and a half. And I managed to, I bought the first three movies and watched them with my dad. He loved them. I loved them. And we were both looking forward to the fourth one. And it was supposed to come out in 2021, May of 2021. And actually, it was supposed to be released alongside the fourth Matrix movie. But, of course, that didn't pan out the way they wanted it to. The producers and, you know, everyone working on the movies wanted it to, because the pandemic hit in 2020 and the movie kept getting pushed back. It was supposed to be released in 2022. And then at the end of 2021, it was pushed back to March of 2023. And then it's like, okay, so now we have to wait a little bit over a year, and like a year and 3 months now. So, it kept getting pushed back further and further, but eventually, yeah, they got to the March 2023 release date. And finally, it was released on March, it was March 24th, 2023. And this movie, basically, yeah, if you've been following the John Wick movies, the third movie ended with John trying to enact his revenge on the High Table for, you know, basically making his life a living hell in the last movie, where, you know, they issued a $14 million contract to all the assassins in the world to bring him in dead or alive. Mostly dead. And yeah, he decides to team up with Winston, and he teams up with the Bowery King in his plan to finally get rid of the High Table once and for all. And what follows from there is action set piece after action set piece, and John and some of his allies, old and new, beating the shit out of and murdering several other assassins and low-level hitmen and cronies who are, you know, interested in the bounty. And of course, the contract, the amount, like with the third one, gets raised a little bit throughout the movie, which I just love the fact that they kept adding more to the bounty, because it's like, you know, at a certain point, I feel like some of those hitmen would be like, you know what, screw it, it's not worth it. Because, like, obviously John Wick has a reputation because he's Baba Yaga, the boogeyman. I mean, not just for what he did in the third movie, but what he did in the second and first movie, and what he did before any of the events we saw in the first movie. Like, he clearly had a reputation pre-John Wick 1, you know? So it's like, before we saw anything in the first one, it's like, oh yeah, he was doing this for a while. So it's like, yeah, I feel like at some point none of them decided, you know what, this isn't worth it. I know I'm just going to die. he's too badass. You know, he cannot be taken out. But yeah, I mean, the acting and Keanu Reeves, I feel like he was better earlier in the series. He's not terrible. It's just he's better to me at the action, like doing his own stunts and stuff, than he is like acting. He's not a terrible actor. Like, he's not the worst actor. And I don't want to say that he's a bad actor, because he's genuinely seems like a nice guy. It's just, I feel like his acting, he had more to do in the previous movies. And like with each movie, it seems like he had less to say, and because there kept being more and more action set pieces and more characters added that were kind of on some levels a little bit more interesting than him at times. But again, that's not to say he does a bad job. It's just, he was a little bit more, not fleshed out, but he had like more to say. It was just a little bit more interesting in the first few. But again, I do love seeing his story evolve and continue. I love seeing the world building, you know, with the Continental, seeing all the, and seeing Continental hotels throughout the world. Like, we get to see one in Japan, which the Osaka Continental, which I thought was, I loved the action set piece there. That was great. You know, the acting from everyone else is pretty good. Donnie Yen plays this blind assassin who does a great job. He plays Kane. Yeah, he's a blind High Table assassin. He was great. Bill Skarsgård does a great job as the Marquis de Grammel. He's the main antagonist. He's a member of the High Table. Lawrence Fishburne, and, you know, as the Bowery King, he comes back. Excuse me. And Ian McShane as Winston, obviously the manager of the New York Continental. They do great job. Clancy Brown has a small role as the Harbinger. He's a high-ranking operative of the High Table. and they all do great. And and Hiroyuki Sanada plays, it doesn't have a big role, but he's the manager of the Osaka Continental, and they're all pretty good. And yeah, everyone else I didn't mention by name, they were all great. Shamir Anderson plays hitman Mr. Nobody, who's got a dog of his own, so that helps him out in fights, which was pretty cool to see. And I love the way they handled the situation with Lance Reddick, because he died a week before the movie was released. So I was curious how they were going to kill off Sharon, his character, and or if they were just going to have him leave. But he ends up dying pretty early in the movie. The marquee blows up. He calls Winston and Sharon to a meeting. He makes them watch as he blows up the Continental, their Continental, and then he shoots Sharon. And his final scene with Winston, he's like, I forgot exactly what he said, but it was something like, "It was nice knowing you, my friend." And I was like, "Oh man, that sucks." But I was shocked that he died so soon. I figured he was going to be in more of the movie, but I guess they maybe were trying to figure out how to write him out, and they're like, "Well, we'll just kill him off early. It'll come off as more of a shock." But I like the way they handled it, and he was great as Sharon. It's sad we lost him. He was a great actor. He was also in Lost for a few episodes. He was pretty good in that too. Everyone else I didn't mention by name. They were all great, and the movie ended with John dying, but we don't. I mean, we see him collapsing, but we don't see the. And then we see Winston and the Bowery King, at his grave. But and it's like right next to his wife Helen's grave, but it's like, I don't know if he's actually dead. Because they said they were going to make a fifth one, and I'm assuming they still are, so it's like, well, how are they going to do a fifth one if he's dead? So that leads me to believe that he faked his death, because, you know, he hasn't fully killed every one of all the members of the High Table. He just ended up, he only killed the Marquis. He only killed one member, you know, so. But who knows? And then, of course, there's a post-credit scene that sets up Kane meeting up with his daughter and then being approached by Akira, who was the daughter of the Osaka Continental Hotel owner, Shimazu. And, you know, it was setting up, maybe that's going to continue on into the fifth one. Who knows? But yeah, movie again was great. Did great at the box office. It made $440.1 million against a $100 million budget. And yeah, I mean, we're getting the spinoff movie Ballerina in June. Yeah, June 7th of next year. Well, I say next year. I mean, it technically is next year, but tomorrow will be next year. So this upcoming year, so 2024. And then the fifth movie is going to be released sometime soon. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, it's great action movie. Same with the other three. And to me, even though it's a little long, you maybe could have like trimmed some of the action scenes down. Again, that's my only nitpick. Same with Oppenheimer, is maybe it's a little too long because it's like 2 hours, 45 minutes. But some of the action scenes could have been cut down, but other than that, it was really good. The cinematography was shot really well, and the acting was great. The action scenes were, you know, the fighting styles and the cuts between, you know, the action scenes. There weren't too many cuts. So I loved that. And yeah, it was, to me, every movie gets better than the previous one. So I'm looking forward to see what they do with the fifth one. And now with that being said, let's move on to number six. At number six, we have Scream 6. Now, like with the John Wick movies, I did not get into the Scream movies until well after most of them had been released. I remember the trailers that preceded Halloween Kills in 2021. I remember seeing the trailer for the fifth Scream movie, and I was like, oh, that looks pretty good. And of course, I knew about Scream enough. Like I knew the Ghostface image. I had heard the saying, you know, his catchphrase, you know, you want to, or not, no, that's Saul. Sorry. I was going to say, do you want to play a game? No, it's do you like scary movies? You know, I was familiar with The Mask. And I knew it was a huge horror movie franchise. But I didn't, other than that, I didn't know much about it. but the trailer looked good, and I figured, oh, you know, well, on Halloween, I'll start watching the Scream movies. And I started with the first one. I watched it. I don't think it was Halloween night. Maybe it was the 30th or 29th. But, you know, it towards Halloween, I watched the first one, loved it. And then I proceeded to watch the, you know, buy and watch the 2 through 4. I loved them too. And then I went to go see the fifth one when it came out, which was January of 2022. So last year. And I loved it too. And then, you know, so I was excited when they announced that the sixth one would be released like pretty much a year after the fifth one, or a year and like 2 months. And it came out in March of this year, March 10th. So a couple weeks before John Wick 4 did. And this movie, basically, because the Scream movies follow, well, you know, at least the first four and part of five followed Sidney Prescott, Gale Weathers, and Dewey Riley. The core three, the gang, basically having to deal with another masked killer, another copycat who's copying the Ghostface murders from the first movie. And in the first one, it was Sydney's boyfriend. Spoiler alert! But it was Sydney's boyfriend. It was Sydney's boyfriend. His friend Stu Mocker and her boyfriend Billy Loomis. So yeah, it was a boyfriend Billy and his friend Stu. Sorry, I forgot his name for a second. But yeah, and then after the first one, and what I think's cool is that with each movie, it's always the same voice. Like it's always because every killer has the same voice box that makes that alters their voice to sound like the Ghostface voice, and it's always the same black robe and mask. But it's always a new killer. Unlike most horror movies where every movie it's like, oh, it's the same person, you know, it's the same killer. But because they're all human and they all die at the end of every movie, it's always a copycat, someone new. And this movie, it's no exception. This one, it's someone new too. And with this one, you know, the fifth movie, because it came out, you know, like 11 years after the fourth one did, you know, we started off with like a whole new group of plucky young teenagers. Same with, you know, how Scream started, you know, it had, you know, Sydney and her friends, you know, a group of plucky teenagers. And, you know, we get a new group of teenagers in the fifth one. And then, you know, throughout the movie, we're reintroduced to Dewey and Gale and Sydney, the, you know, legacy characters, as they refer to them, the gang. And with this one, you know, and then the fifth one, yeah, they go through the same thing that Sydney, Gale, and Dewey went through. They have to solve their... You know, they have to go through their own Ghostface murder spree and find out who is, you know, hunting them down and killing them and kill him or her. And this one, and, you know, and it was pretty much, and it was similar to the last few movies because it's similar in the sense that, oh, it takes place in Woodsboro, same as one and four did take place in Woodsboro as well. Two and three didn't, but one and four also took place in Woodsboro, same with five. And, you know, the finale was set in Stu's house, which was kind of a callback to the first one, because the finale, the final act of the first one took place in his house as well. And with this one, I like that they switched it up a little bit. Instead of being in Woodsboro, we're, like with 2 and 3, we're in a new location. We're in New York, and it's a year after the fifth one. The events of the fifth one, Sam and Tara, the sisters in the first, not the first one, the previous one, and Chad and Mindy, their friends, who they all collectively call themselves the Core Four, are, you know, going to college, living their lives in New York. And unfortunately for them, because they got caught up in this whole mess, you know, in the last movie, there is another Ghostface killer out targeting them again, you know, the year after their first Ghostface encounter. And but they're not alone. They have some new faces, some new members of the group helping them, as well as Gale from the previous movie. And as a bonus, we get another legacy character, Kirby Reed, from the fourth one. And I was so happy they brought Kirby back because she was one of my favorite characters in the fourth one. And not to mention her actress, what was her name? Hayden Panettiere. Yeah, she is gorgeous, and she's only gotten more beautiful with age and time. But yeah, she did a great job. I loved what they did with her character because they made her a cop, And I loved that that seemed like the logical step for her character, because she always, she did seem like the survivor type. She was, and she was like the last one to make it out, other than the core group. You know, she was kind of like the only teenager to survive at the end of the movie. And it's funny because they kind of make it seem like that she didn't. It's like, oh, did she? Because we don't really pick back up on her after we leave. I went in the final scene with the hospital after they killed, after Sydney kills her, was it her niece? Yeah, I think it was her niece. Yeah, her niece, Jill. She ends up, you know, she dies, and then we kind of end there. So it's like we just assume Kirby died. But then in the fifth one, they had the Easter egg. If you look in the corner of this YouTube video that Tara's or Sam's boyfriend's watching, it says, oh, interview with Woodsboro survivor Kirby Reed. So it's like, oh, nice. And that was kind of foreshadowing her return in the sixth one. So yeah, while the movie doesn't have Dewey because he died in the previous one, and Sydney wasn't there because they, her, Neve Campbell felt like she wasn't getting paid enough money, that she felt like her, what they were paying her wasn't enough for how long she had been on the part of the series. You know, we only have Gale, but they brought back Kirby, so that was kind of nice to have another legacy character join the group again. And I loved that they didn't end up killing her. I love that she's still alive. And yeah, I love the setting. I love that we're in New York. I love the ghost face mask is like more worn out and weathered, and like it just makes it look even more creepy. And we end up getting three ghost faces, and I love the twist with who they are. And I love that there are three, because like besides the third one, which only had one ghost face, every other movie has had at least two ghost faces. So I love that this movie kind of flipped the script in a way, and it's like, oh no, we have three. It's like, oh shit, okay. And you know, again, I didn't really see it coming. I was like, oh okay, but in retrospect, the twist made sense. It's like, oh okay, so you three are the ghost faces. Okay, nice. And yeah, I just, you know, and again, Jenna Ortega as Tara, she was great. Great actress, beautiful too. Melissa Barrera as Sam, her sister, they were great. The Chad and Mindy were great. And of course, Roger L. Jackson killed it as the voice of Ghostface. He's been doing it for 25 years. You know, he's still fantastic. And of course, Courtney Cox as Gale was great, and Hayden Panettiere. So the acting all across the board was great. The kills were pretty inventive too. One involving a dumpster, one involving a shotgun. You know, again, what you would want in a horror movie, some pretty creative, inventive deaths. Something new for Ghostface, because a lot of Ghostface deaths involve him or her, whichever Ghostface it is in whichever movie, stabbing the victims. So it's nice when they switch it up. And yeah, and it was great. And the end credits song sounded very similar to a song you'd hear from one of the first three Scream movies. It sounded very late 90s, early 2000s like. And that Demi Lovato song, Still Alive, that was fantastic. I loved that. And I didn't know, I thought it was like, oh, is that like a 90s, 2000s song? But no, they made it for the movie. And I just love how it sounds like it's from that era of when the first three movies came out. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the seventh one, but the director left after that whole debacle with Melissa Barrera. I mean, and again, she didn't pick a side. She was just saying that the war between Israel and Palestine is getting out of hand, and we should all just try to be love each other and stop this rivalry. And of course, Paramount fired her. And then Jenna left because she's like, well, if Sam's not going to be in the movie, or Melissa's not going to be playing Sam, I'm not going to be playing Tara. And then the director, who was going to direct the seventh one, left. So it's like, well, shit, like, what are we going to do, you know? But hopefully they can hire them back, because I did like what they were doing with these new, with the core four. And if you don't have Tara and Sam, it's like, are you going to kill them off screen in the next movie? Is it just going to be Chad and Mindy? Like, we're just going to have two characters from the fifth one still around, like of the original group that was introduced in the fifth one. It's like, okay, I guess, but who knows? I'm sure they'll figure something out, but yeah. And the movie did great. It had a budget of, it was like between 33 and 35 million, and it grossed 169 million at the box office, making it the highest grossing Scream film of all time. And yeah, it was the, Yeah. So yeah, the highest grossing Scream film in the series, and it was the first to earn over $100 million at the domestic U.S. box office since Scream 2. So yeah, loved the movie. Looking forward to the seventh one, and yeah, I guess that does it. So now moving on to, we're halfway through the list. Now let's move on to number five. At number five, we have Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Now, everyone's had been very much looking forward to this movie ever since the end of the Guardians 2 and their appearances in Infinity War and Endgame, especially at the end of Endgame, when the last we saw of them was the Guardians and Thor leaving Earth to, you know, seemingly go off on their own cosmic adventures through space. And we saw a little bit of that in Love and Thunder. And then, of course, we got the Guardians Christmas special last November. So it was a little over a year ago. So we got that last year. And yeah, everyone was curious to see, since this was, you know, supposedly the final, at least the final Guardians movie that James Gunn was directing, how was this movie going to end the trilogy? You know, was it going to end on a satisfying note? And I think it very much did. If this is the last we see of the Guardians, I think this was a very satisfying note for them to end on, at least with this trilogy. We may see them again. I don't know if we'll see them again in another movie, all together as a team, or what. But if we never see them again, I feel like this movie wrapped things up perfectly for everyone, and it ended on a very satisfying note. But basically, the movie follows the Guardians. You know, which was established in the Christmas special, but, you know, it's reestablished here. They bought Nowhere from the Collector, and they're living there. That's their base, their home planet, which really is just the skull of a dead Celestial. which I thought was kind of funny when we found that out in the first movie. It's like, oh, it's just a giant skull. Like, it's a dead giant. And we found out later it was a Celestial. But yeah, they're living on Nowhere. That's their home base. Everything's going well. You know, people are, they're rebuilding the planet. Everyone who's living there seems to be doing all right until Adam Warlock shows up and gets into a skirmish with him, which causes Rocket to get seriously injured. He gets seriously injured in the fight, and the rest of the Guardians have to save him from dying and protect him from his creator, the High Evolutionary, who pretty much, you know, and when we get a lot of Rocket's, pretty much all of Rocket's backstory, or most of it, the important stuff, or the most important stuff in the movie, and we get, yeah, we find out that, yeah, for ever since he was a little raccoon, he had been tortured and experimented on and belittled and just abused verbally and physically by this asshole who, you know, believes himself to be a god and, you know, just the creator of life, which, I mean, he is technically a creator of life, but yeah, he's just a very smug asshole who, you know, his whole deal is trying to make the perfect society. And he was trying to do that with animals that he would bestow. He would basically, his first few experiments, he kind of, you know, ripped off their limbs and like added robotic attachments and was basically just trying to alter their brain chemistries and their physical abilities to resemble a more human-like appearance. And one of his first experiments was on Rocket. And yeah, and we find out a lot more about Rocket's backstory and his friends and their deaths, which was very sad, that scene where the High Evolutionary kills them as they're trying to escape. And it was cool to see Rocket go from like this barely intelligible raccoon, like barely able to like, he was just a normal little baby raccoon, to being able to speak smaller sentences, to being the Rocket we know now, you know, being able to fully speak on his own, you know, the kind of smart, tech savvy, quick on his feet, genius that he is in a way. And, sarcastic, sometimes asshole genius that he is. And yeah, I loved that, what they did with Rocket's backstory. And the acting from everyone was great too. I mean, Bradley Cooper did a great job voice acting for Rocket. Chris Pratt as Star-Lord is great. Zoe Saldana as Gamora was great. Dave Bautista, Karen Gillian as Drax and Nebula. Pom Klimatief was great as Mantis. Vin Diesel was great as Groot. It was the voice. Austin Freeman did the motion capture for him. And Will Poulter, I thought, was a funny addition as Adam Warlock. How he goes from being this... Because the Sovereign created this... he's basically a artificial being. They created him at the end of the second one, we see in the post-credit scene, to destroy the Guardians. And the High Priestess, the head of the Sovereign, was like, yeah, he's basically a baby because we had to hatch him early. He wasn't, ready to leave his cocoon. So he's kind of like very socially awkward and not really understanding of life, you know? And so it was interesting to see him go from, just being the soldier following orders to, kill the Guardians, to being confused about what to do next, to losing his mother, the high priestess dies, to then kind of joining the Guardians and working with them at the end of the movie. And I thought that was really cool. Sean Gunn, James Gunn's brother, the director, James Gunn, his brother Sean Gunn comes back as Kraglin again, and he's great. Chukwudi Iwuji, I hope I'm not butchering his name, but he was the High Evolutionary. I thought he was a great villain, and he had some very intense scenes where he was just screaming at Rocket, and just his smug assholeness was just, he's such a smug asshole. He did a great job at just being a dick, did a great job with being a villain. And I thought he was a great villain too in the, for him to be the last villain, I thought he was pretty good. And then of course, we have some more, all the other actors that I mentioned by name, they were great too. But I feel like the movie overall, great final story for the Guardians, great final mission for the entire team to go on before they all split up. I thought the acting was great. Yeah, the acting was great. The soundtrack again was on point, including the addition of like some 90s and 2000s songs. I thought it was nice considering the first two were mostly 70s and 80s. So I loved that they added some more recent songs from some more recent decades. I loved that. And the practical effects and like the makeup on the aliens and the different planets they went to, which was always a highlight of the first two, seeing all the weird, unique planets they went to. That was great. Just the sense of finality that the movie gave, I loved. And I didn't see the Marvels, but this was definitely better than Quantumania. Yeah, definitely Marvel. I feel like even if I saw the Marvels, I'd still think this was Marvel's best film of the year. And most people agree with me because its budget was $250 million, and it grossed $845.6 million at the box office. So it did really well. And thankfully, Disney hired James Gunn back after they stupidly fired him for some tweets that he apologized for years ago, and that the ones that were released years ago that he had already apologized for. Thankfully, Disney reversed their decision and hired him back because... that was those movies were kind of his babies, and I couldn't see really anyone else finishing the trilogy as perfectly as he did. Just the sense of, like I said, the sense of finality and the way everyone's individual stories, the character arcs, and the way their stories wrap up, and they all have something to do, and their stories, all of their individual stories end on a beautiful note. And yeah, it just, it was great. And hopefully we'll see the Guardians again in the future, whether they're all in a team or whether we see them individually in different movies. But looking forward to it, seeing what we do next. We know Star-Lord Peter is going to return because they said it in the, how they all Marvel movies have that at the end where they're like, after the post-credits scene, it's like, so-and-so will return in this movie or later. And they said that as like, Star-Lord will return. So I'm like, okay. Because he's on Earth now with his grandfather, so I'm assuming... we'll see him on Earth at some point. Maybe he'll be a hero on Earth. Who knows? But yeah, now we're in the final four. So with that being said, let's move on to number four. At number four, we have the Super Mario Brothers movie. Yet another movie that people were very much looking forward to for this year. And it also did not disappoint. It was also a juggernaut at the box office. Its budget was $100 million, and it grossed $1.36 billion at the box office. And yeah, I think it's very much deserved. Now, I am not the hugest fan of Mario, but what I do love about the movie is that even if you aren't the biggest Mario fan, like you haven't played all the games, there is enough. There's enough references in there to pretty much the entire history and legacy of Mario to where there's something in there for even the fans of like the old, you know, Donkey Kong game. You know, there's references to that. There's references to Mario Kart, which was what I played a lot of when I was little. I forgot which number Mario Kart it was. Like, I'm not sure if it was 6 or 7. I think they're like, I believe they're numbered. But I used to play Mario Kart a lot on the Wii when I was younger, and I loved that game. And there is a section where they're basically driving carts across the Rainbow Bridge, and I'm like, oh shit, I loved doing that when I was younger. And we just see this whole scene of Mario and Donkey Kong and his people and them all riding out these tricked out carts, and that was awesome. But yeah, the movie, you know, based on the Nintendo video game franchise, which in itself is a juggernaut, and a cash cow. And but it was also, yeah, it's based on the Nintendo video game franchise, and it was released by Illumination, who you may all know as the animation studio behind the Despicable Me movies, the Sing movies, and so on and so forth. But yeah, they to me, I think this is one of their best movies. And in terms of the humor and the writing and the animation is gorgeous. And to top it off, And I love what they did with the plot, too, because basically the plot, it's an origin story about Mario and Luigi. They're in Brooklyn, and they're, you know, the Italian-American plumbers. They have their own it's a kind of a fixer-upper, but, you know, they have their own little plumbing company, just the two of them. And there's this leak that happens underneath Brooklyn, and, you know, the sewers are leaking out onto the street. So they're like, oh, we can fix this, and we'll definitely get our names out there. And they go down there, and they end up getting sucked into the, or transported. They go to the green pipe, you know, you go through to get to like the next level. They end up getting transported, sucked in through that green pipe into the Mushroom Kingdom, the world of the Mushroom Kingdom. And, that's just one section of the world, but you know, they're transported to the world of the video games. Or of the video game, and they encounter Princess Peach and her people, the Koopas. I mean, not the Koopas, that's Bowser's people. Her people, the Mushroom people, in the Mushroom Kingdom. And she's like, look, we need your help. If you're willing to help us, we've got this big bad Turtle King, Bowser, and his army of Koopas. And, you know, he keeps trying to take over, and keeps trying to marry me, and we need you to help us win the battle, help us win our battle between him, and you know, like a lot of the video games involve. And on top of Mario, Luigi, Princess Peach, Bowser, we've also got Donkey Kong. He shows up. We get a cameo by Yoshi, which was cool, and then the post credit scene kind of teases Yoshi showing up in the sequel. And we get Donkey Kong's father, Cranky Kong, and yeah, just pretty much the main Mario characters. We don't get Wario, we don't get Waluigi, we don't get the baby Mario and Luigi, but you know, we get like the core, like the ones that everyone knows, you know, the Mario, Luigi, Peach. And yeah, I think that, I mean, the animation on all of them is great. Music, I mean, a lot of it is like popular music, but I do like the placement of it in the movie. And they do incorporate the Mario theme, the da 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 in the movie, in a commercial that Mario and Luigi have for their plumbing business, and it's the and they actually incorporate the theme song from the old like 90s cartoon, and I love the commercial. I talked about it when I talked about my top 10 favorite Super Bowl commercials from this year, because that Super Bowl commercial for the movie was pretty much the commercial for their plumbing business. But I just love the commercial, just the woman in it, her reading off the dialogue on the cue card and being confused about it, and the fact they left that in the commercial, the old like VHS type filter to where it looks like it was like filmed in like the 80s or 90s. Just them doing the job and like dancing to the beat while they're doing the job, Mario and Luigi. That was great. But yeah, I mean, and on top of the animation and just all the references to all of the history of all the Mario games and the references within the games or to the games, the voice acting's great. I mean, Chris Pratt, you know, everyone thought he was going to suck as Mario, but I think he actually does a pretty good job. He doesn't play up the stereotypicalness, the stereotypical Italian accent. You know, I mean, he downplays it. It's a little bit more of a Brooklyn, New York accent. Charlie Day was great as Luigi. Keegan-Michael Key was great as Toad. Anya Taylor-Joy, I loved as Princess Peach. And Jack Black. And Seth Rogen was pretty good as Donkey Kong. And Jack Black was fantastic as Bowser. It took me actually a second to realize it was him. Or I kept forgetting at certain points that it was him. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's Jack Black. Because he does such a great job at putting on this big, booming, intimidating, gravelly voice. And not to mention, because Jack Black can sing his ass off, the musical number, Peaches, his song in there, his love ballad about Peach, Princess Peach, where he's playing the piano, that is, you know, one of my favorite and pretty much a lot of people's favorite scene in the movie. And yeah, that was a fantastic scene. And I loved the movie. I didn't see it when it was released. It was released like April 5th. I saw it a few weeks later. And part of me kind of regrets that, because, I mean, there were a decent amount of people in there, but I would have loved to have seen it like opening night with a packed theater. I feel like that would have added more to the experience too. But yeah, I mean, people were laughing. People were enjoying it. There were enough people. It just wasn't as packed as it would have been had I went opening night. But no, I loved the movie. And if they do a second one, I hope it's just as good. I hope they don't really change too much. I mean, I hope they do something a little different, but I hope they kind of stick to what worked with this one and don't veer off of that path too much, you know, like, and obviously, you know, stay in touch with Nintendo to make sure, you know, you follow the look and the style of the games and all that. And hopefully it should be good. But yeah, now we're on to the final three. Let's move on to number three. At number three, we have Killers of the Flower Moon, another film by another big-name director, Martin Scorsese. This is his latest movie, and it is based on the true story of the Osage murders in Oklahoma in the early 20s. But basically, the film follows Ernest Burkhart. He's a World War I soldier. He returns to Oklahoma to live with his uncle, William Keene Hale. And everything seems to be fine. Like the people of Oklahoma, the white people of Oklahoma, and the Native American members of Oklahoma, of the Osage tribe, they seem to be getting along well. Upon first glance, everything seems fine, but over the course of the movie, we slowly start to see their numbers dwindling. More and more of them are being murdered, and it's not too long before we find out that Hale, Ernest's uncle, is behind it, and he recruits his naive, thick-headed, nephew into helping him thin out the population. And basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to and one way they're trying to do that is by marrying off their people to the to members of the Osage tribe, having them have children, then killing the mothers and then or fathers, you know, whoever, and then making sure that the money and the oil flows directly back to them. Because it's like, oh, well, there are children, and since the Osei, the spouse who was, you know, a Native American member, of the, you know, one of the spouse who was a Native American, they're dead. Well, the children are half our ours, so the money will go back to us and the oil. And the Osage tribe had recently, you know, they're rich and they're living it up, and they have a ton of money because they struck oil in Oklahoma. And Hale is trying to make sure that the oil and money go back to the white men and to the white people. And yeah, I loved the movie. Again, like with John Wick and Oppenheimer, or John Wick 4 and Oppenheimer, it was a little long. It maybe could have been a little shorter. And again, I'm going to say again what I said with those two movies. I still don't know what I would trim. I don't know what I would cut down, you know, because everything kind of played its part. Everything had a place and a point to it. So I don't know what I would cut out or what scenes I would trim down to make it shorter. But I really liked it. And, you know, ever since I saw the first trailer for it back in May, I was like, oh, this looks really good. This looks very intense. And I haven't seen a lot of Scorsese's movies. In fact, I think I've only seen The Wolf of Wall Street. But I love that movie. It's a fantastic movie. And this movie was great, too. And like with The Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio kills it in his performance in this movie as Ernest. He was great. Robert De Niro was fantastic as his uncle, Keen Hale. And, you know, over the course of the movie, you start to despise his character more and more because, you know, his continuation, him continually murdering and ruining the lives, murdering the members of the Osage tribe and ruining the lives of the tribe themselves. You know, it's like, he's just a terrible person. And it's like, how far is he willing to go? And it's crazy because, you know, how a lot of evil people, a lot of evil people tend to learn the correct terminology of the people that they hate or that they're trying to get rid of. And Hale does this perfectly. Like, he is such a inconspicuous person among the tribe, like that, because he doesn't directly kill the people. I mean, at least not at first. He doesn't directly kill the Osage tribe members. He has other people working for him do it. But he has ingratiated. He's integrated himself so much into the tribe that he's friends with, like, the chief and, like, most of the members of the tribe. He's very friendly and polite, and he's even gone so far as to learn their language. He speaks their language and switches back and forth between their language and English in conversation. So it's like the fact that he is putting on such a happy, positive face and pretending to be nice or being nice and then just turning his back and murdering most of the people. It's like, this guy's insane and sick, you know, and evil. he's smart too. That's the crazy thing. He's evil, but he's smart. Cause he's like, look, if I put on this nice face, no one's going to suspect that I had anything to do with it. But he did a great job as Robert De Niro tends to do and Leo tends to do. Oh, and Lily Gladstone plays Ernest's wife. She's a member of the Osage tribe. Her name, Molly, is Molly. And I loved when she finally figured out what was going on. Like, over the course of the film, she figured out what was going on. And eventually, at the end of the movie, left Ernest. I was like, good, because, I mean, if he really loved you, he would have not helped his uncle kill your people. But at the same time, I did love their relationship, and I feel like Ernest genuinely did love her. But still, like I just said, if he really did love her, he would have put a stop to what his uncle was doing, you know. But she did a great job. Oh, and Jesse Plemons, who played Todd in Breaking Bad, is the Bureau of Investigation agent who's, you know, sniffing around in Oklahoma trying to figure out, you know, who's this epidemic, as he puts it, of murders. And he does a great job, too. And of course, everyone else, I didn't mention by name, were great, too. But those are, like, the main characters. And they do a good job. And I love, because with most movies that have that end with, that are based on true stories, most of them end with, like, pictures of the people in that the movie is talking about. It ends with, you know, pictures of the person in real life and, like, a blurb, you know, a couple blurbs talking about what happened next. But I like what they do something a little different instead of doing that in this movie. They do something a little different to that. They have like this play that they have this play put on explaining the epilogue and what happened next with all these characters in real life. And I thought that was cool because it's something different and unique than just having the, you know, the pictures of the people in real life and blurbs describing what happened. And we get a cameo from Martin Scorsese, so I thought that was cool. But yeah, sadly it didn't gross more over its budget. It made $156.3 million and its budget was $200 million, but people still nevertheless seemed to like it. You know, people loved the cinematography, which it was great. It, you know, was very crystal clear, beautifully shot. The music was great, where they included a bunch of like Native American, like tribal drumming and chanting, and it made some of the scenes more intense when someone was about to be murdered or discovering a dead body. And yeah, the acting was great, and yeah, I mean, and it proves that, you know, some people only get better with age, or at least continue to do as good of a job as they usually do with age. And Martin Scorsese has only, if not gotten better, he's at least stayed at the level he's been at, which is, again, from the only movie I've seen of his being The Wolf of Wall Street, is a pretty damn good level to be at. And yeah, he's 81 and he's still doing, producing a movie as good as this, you know, I'd say that's pretty good. So yeah, great movie. And now we're coming up the final two. Now let's move on to number two. At number two, we have Barbie. Yes, since Oppenheimer was on this list, I had to put Barbie on the list. And obviously, it's a very higher place on the list than Oppenheimer. But yeah, the movie, if you haven't seen it, like I said, with Oppenheimer, it was released on the same day, July 21st of this year, and it did even better than Oppenheimer. But I'll get into that in a minute. But basically, the movie follows Barbie, who is living it up in Barbie Land with all the other Barbies and Kens, until one day she something strange happens. She has a full-on existential crisis. Her heels, because you know all the Barbies stand on their tiptoes. That's how they're made. Her feet are flat, become flat. She starts questioning. You know, just asking all these questions about life and death, full on. Yeah. Like I said, full on existential crisis. She finds out she can't float off the top of, her roof like she used to. She just falls straight down and she's like, what's happening? And she decides to take a journey to the real world, accompanied with, of course, Ken. Ken decides to tag along. And, you know, what follows is a bizarre, hilarious, heartfelt adventure about what it means to be, you know, you know, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a human, what it means to you know, like just be a child and have children who, you know, share the same interests that you did in your toys when you were a child. You know, it's just the movie does a great job at like tackling all of these, I mean, not issues, but tackling all of these topics and doing a pretty good job at the execution of like of everything. And, you know, and just people and the fact that, like, you know, that stupid ass phrase, go woke or go broke. People thought, oh, well, this movie's going woke because, you know, it's like, oh, well, Barbie and Ken aren't even don't even get together, and the posters are so dismissive of Ken, where the tagline was like, oh, she's Barbie, he's just Ken, or she's everything and he's just Ken, you know. And it's like, I mean, they're not, I mean, the joke was that Ken was kind of tagging along and Barbie was trying to just, you know, she didn't want to hurt his feelings, but she was like, look, I'm just not really that interested in a romantic relationship, which was totally fine. But the problem is people were like, oh, yeah, well, no, Ken and Barbie have to be together because they've always been together. And it's like, well, I mean, they don't always have to. I mean, they are a couple in a way. But, like, I thought it was very interesting that the movie didn't have them get together. I thought it was interesting that they went their own separate ways, and that Ken learned that he was enough. You know, he was enough by himself. Like, he didn't need, you know, him discovering that he didn't need to be always with Barbie to be his own person. Like, being with Barbie wasn't his defining characteristic. Like, that wasn't all he was Barbie's accessory, you know, her boyfriend. He was more than that. He was enough just being himself. And I thought that was sweet. And, you know, that's true to a lot of guys, you know, like, they're, you know, and a lot of people in relationships, it's like they're themselves, and they're enough. You know, it's not just them and their relationship with their significant other. It's like they're enough just individually by themselves. I thought that was sweet. I liked that. and yeah, just the movie, I mean, on top of it being heartfelt and talking about, you know, kind of what it means to be human and what it means to, you know, be a child, you know, have children who enjoy the what you grew up with, and to just still kind of be reminiscent and nostalgic about your childhood toys, you know, it's also very heartfelt, but it's also very funny too. And I just loved the color palette. I loved all the different shades of pink. You know, there's a lot of pink in the movie, but it looked great. I loved how they made Barbie Land look, because it does look very plastic, and it's very colorful, like the actual Barbie dollhouses and the playsets. The wardrobes were great for everyone, including Barbie and Ken. Every time they switched to a different costume, I'm like, perfect. Like, the cowboy outfits were great. And obviously, and yeah, Margot Robbie is gorgeous. Another one of my celebrity crushes. I think my favorite outfit of hers for me personally was the cowboy outfit. She looked stunning in that. but yeah, I mean, you know, the roller skate, the 80s roller skating, look, the pink dress, the disco look, like, you know, and, Ken's look when he comes back and takes over Barbie Land, him and the Kens, which that was a funny little, cause they basically go to the real world, and Ken, learns everything he can about the patriarchy and what it means to be a man in like half a day. So he thinks he's learned everything. He's like, oh, well, I'll go back and make Barbie Land better. And his whole musical number, I'm Just Ken, was fantastic. The choreography and all that was great with it. But yeah, I mean, it's just hilarious all the way through. And you know, they just make several jokes about the toys themselves. Like, the fact that Barbie, jumps off her roof and floats down to the ground. Cause it's like, oh yeah, even if you didn't have a Barbie, everyone did that with their action figures or toys, where they didn't have them walk down the stairs of whatever house or the shelf or desk or whatever, wherever they were on. They didn't have them like walk down or fly down, or they just kind of had them like, they just picked them up and floated them down, you know, drag, like slowly kind of made them float down. And so like, I love that that's how they get down the stairs. It's like, they don't actually walk down the stairs. Whenever, like every time they're at the beach or at their pool, the water's plastic. So like, there's a scene where Barbie's walking, on her pool, like on the water. And yeah, just, I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, I'd be here all night. I could be here all night listening to listing off all the jokes and everything about the movie. But yeah, it's just very heartfelt, very funny. And it was one of the biggest movies of the summer, and it grossed a lot of money. It had a budget, it was around 128 and 145 million, and it grossed $1.442 billion at the box office. So it was another big box office success, and one of the biggest successes of the summer, in a summer of movies, or in a year of summer blockbusters that didn't really, that kind of flopped. Like Indiana Jones 5, Elemental didn't do so well, The Flash didn't really do so well, Transformers not so hot, you know, Transformers 7, I think, or, you know, Rise of the Beasts. There were just a bunch of movies back to back to back. And, you know, I feel like they kind of suffered from there being releasing too many movies at once, and them all just not maybe being the best that they could be, you know what I mean? And having more effort put into them would have helped them, I feel like. And also having putting more effort into them would have helped, Then again, I didn't see all of them, but I think the reason I didn't see as many as I did was because there were so many back to back, and I just kept hearing things like, it was okay. And that just kind of led me to put it off until later. I'm like, I'll get to it later. And I never did. But, eventually, I mean, I'm sure eventually I'll watch the movies that I missed this year, but you know, with this movie, it's like, there was a lot of attention to detail and thought and care put into this movie. It was very heartfelt and very humorous. And the acting from everyone is great. Like I said, Margot Robbie was great as Barbie, and Ken, Ryan Gosling, they were perfect casting for Barbie and Ken. Will Ferrell played the CEO of Mattel, who, you know, this movie reminds me of the Lego movie in the sense that it's a heartfelt, deep, yet humorous movie about toys, except this is live action. The Lego movie was animated. But, you know, it reminds me of the Lego movie in that aspect. And also the fact that Will Ferrell plays this kind of goofy, slightly evil businessman of a toy company. In this one it's a toy company. And the other one, he was the businessman of, the businessman. He owned everything. His business owned everything in the world. There was a lot of similar. And also on top of that, it had a dope soundtrack. It had a great soundtrack. Soundtrack, I listened to that for I don't know how many times this year, but I listened to it a lot this year. and it was great. And that's why I have it at my number two spot, because it was just a lot of fantastic, the cast was stacked. I didn't even go over America Ferrera was in the movie, Kate McKinnon, Simu Liu, Rhea Perlman. I could go on. But yeah, so the casting was on point, stacked cast. Acting was great. It was humorous, heartfelt, and it was a movie that defied a lot of people's expectations in terms of, you know, a Barbie movie. Well, it'll do good, but surely it won't make over $1 billion. It won't do that good, right? And it proved a lot of people wrong. And it proved that if you go woke, you're not necessarily going to go broke, which I hate that stupid saying. It's stupid. You know, it's just so stupid. It's like, yeah, they had diversity, they touched on feminism, but they didn't go broke. You know, it was a good movie that didn't like really force all of its messages, and like the messages they talked about, yeah, they weren't forced. They did a good job at juggling them in with humor and heartfelt moments. And yeah, it didn't feel forced, and they made bank. You know, they made well over their budget back. So, but yeah, I guess that's all for this movie. And with that being said, let's move on to the number one pick, the final pick. Without further ado, here is number one. And last but not least, at the number one spot, we have Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Now, I went to go see the first movie, Into the Spider-Verse, when it came out in December of 2018. I loved it. Everything about it was great. The animation, the soundtrack, the voice acting, the story, and what they did with the multiverse concept, I thought was fantastic. And so naturally, I was excited and very much looking forward to the sequel. And it is a sequel that, to me, surpasses the first. It is even better than the first. And it not only met my expectations, but it also exceeded my expectations. But the movie continues, you know, from where the... Well, not right where the first one left off, but it's like a year later. And Miles meets up with Gwen Stacy. She comes back to his universe. And they travel across the multiverse and meet up with a team that Gwen works with, a team of spider people known as the Spider Society. And they're all, it's like tens of thousands, probably, if not more, spider people all working together. And the Spider Society resides in Nueva York, which is like New York, but with it's like a Latino New York. And that is in Miguel O'Hara's universe, who is also Spider-Man 2099. And, there is a certain issue that arises with between Miguel and Miles, where Miles is trying to correct something And Miguel says, no, that if you correct it, that goes against the canon. Like, you can't, if something is destined to happen, you know, you can't stop it from happening. It'll happen any either way. If you stop it from happening, it's going to tear your universe apart. You know, your universe is going to be ripped to pieces and erased from existence, like mine was, because I was stupid enough to try to save my daughter's life, and saving her and bringing her to my universe, or saving her and going to her universe, or saving her, that destroyed my universe because she was supposed to die. She ended up dying anyway, along with my entire previous universe. So I have spent my entire life forming the society of spider people and making sure that everything that happens is going to happen and will happen. Even if that means someone you love is going to die, I can't stop you. I can't let you stop that from happening. And so that leads to a little conflict with between Miles and Miguel and the Spider Society, and you know, the tension only builds from that point. And yeah, just the movie, to me, it does everything that a good sequel should do. It builds upon the story that and the world that they set up in the first one. And it doesn't do the exact, it's a good example of a sequel because it doesn't do, or sorry, it's a good example of a great sequel because it doesn't do the exact same story as the first movie did. It continues the story of the first one, and it isn't just a carbon copy of the same plot from the first movie. They build upon the world and the characters and develop them more. And since this is going to be a trilogy, it is a great example of the exciting middle part, because, you know, every good trilogy, you know, there's the big beginning, there's the epic, you know, usually cliffhanger ending middle part that ends on this huge cliffhanger. And then you have the third movie, which is the final ending that ends on, wraps everything up. And this movie was the perfect example of the epic middle part, because it's bigger and better, more grand than the first one. We go to not too many universes, but we go to more. We end up actually going through two other universes, whereas in the first one, we briefly saw the other spider people's universes, but we were mostly in Miles' universe, you know. But with this one, Miles actually traverses the multiverse with Gwen, and we go to see all these other universes. And each one we go to has like a different art style, which I really loved. And the way they blended all the art styles together without it feeling like a jumbled mess, you know, visually, jumbled visual mess, I thought was impressive. I loved all of the art styles, but I think I loved Gwen's the most because it was like a watercolor, had a watercolor look to it. And I just thought it looked beautiful. And I love how the colors in her universe changed depending on like the emotion, like whatever emotion she was feeling in that moment. The colors and the background of her universe kind of changed. And I thought, it's like, man, this looks beautiful. And like, there's several different, images you could just like pause the movie on, and you know, you could just stop it on any frame and be like, oh yeah, that would make a great poster, like to hang on a wall or frame in a picture frame, put on your wall, you know? And yeah, just very visually spectacular. The story was even better than the first one. There was great character development between Miles and Gwen and their budding relationship and all the scenes they were in. I'm like, man, they're adorable. They better get together in the third movie. In the next movie, they better get together. But yeah, they were great by themselves and together. They were cute. They were adorable. Peter was great. You know, and him having a baby, Mayday, him being Spider Dad, you know, with the pink robe and the baby the baby harness and the slippers, and him constantly showing pictures of his kid and talking about her, talking about Mayday. I thought that was sweet. And not to mention, besides Miguel, like, he's a great villain, but the Spot is also a great villain, where at first he just seems like a typical joke villain, like a villain of the week. But throughout the course of the movie, because of something, I won't say what happens, but it's hilarious, because of something that happened in the first movie, he has a grudge against Miles, and he's like, you know what? I am going to kill you and everyone you love. And over the course of the movie, he slowly gains more power, and more, he becomes more and more intimidating. And it's like, oh shit, this is a problem. And you know, it's crazy the way, he goes from like this joke villain to very threatening. And his theme song like sent chills down my spine and my, gave me goosebumps. I was like, oh, this sounds very menacing and creepy. I love it. Like just thinking about it, it's giving me goosebumps. But yeah, and on top of that, and the soundtrack, again, another soundtrack like with Barbie, where I was listening to it throughout the year, like when it was released, I was like, I had it on loop throughout the summer, and I was like, yeah, I love this soundtrack. And to me, I think it was even better than the first movie soundtrack, but that's just me. And the voice acting, I guess I've mentioned everything else. The voice acting was great. Shameik Moore was Miles. He was great. Hailee Steinfeld as Gwen was great. Brian Tyree Henry as Miles' dad was great. Jake Johnson was Peter. Fantastic. Miguel O'Hara was voiced by Oscar Isaac. He was great. Jason Schwartzman was the Spot, who, you know, was also Gideon in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He did a great job. And yeah, just everyone, again, everyone who I didn't mention by name, they killed it in their roles. And yeah, the art style, I guess I mentioned everything. And it was, like with Barbie, it was also another summer blockbuster that actually grossed over its budget. It had like a budget between 100 and 150 million, and it grossed over, it grossed like 690.5 million at the box office. So didn't quite make a billion like Barbie, but it definitely made like twice. At the box office, it made twice as much money as the first movie did, which is impressive to say with any sequel. You know, I feel like that's what you want to say about any sequel. That's something good to say about any sequel to any movie, is that, oh, it made even more than the first one. It was even more of a success. And not to mention that cliffhanger that they end on. I was like, ah, oh, shit. Like, I knew it was going to end on a cliffhanger, because when they first announced it, they said, at first, the original title was Across the Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse Part 1. But, you know, it was supposed to be, and the second one was supposed to be Across the Spider-Verse Part 2, back when that first trailer came out in, like, 2021. But then they renamed it to just Across the Spider-Verse, and then the third one was called, they changed the title of that to Beyond the Spider-Verse. So, but, you know, some people apparently didn't know that there were going to be two movies. Like, this was the first part and then the second part. So, you know, some people didn't know this was going to be a trilogy. So I just loved hearing everyone's, like, moans and groans. Like, what the hell? Seriously? You know, like, oh, man, like, what? Like, it was like everyone's reactions at the end of Infinity War. Like, wait, that's where it ends? We're ending on this? When's the next one? You know, like, everyone's just panicking. But and like maybe slightly pissed off, but I loved it, because I'm like, how many of you knew there was a part three, you know? But yeah, it was great. I loved the cliffhanger, and it was supposed to premiere, the Beyond the Spider-Verse was supposed to premiere in March of next year, or of this upcoming year, but it got pushed back because of the writer's strike. So I think it's supposed to premiere in 2025. But I'm curious to see how they wrap up the trilogy. The first two have been great, and I have no idea, and, you know, the second being better than the first, and I have no doubt in my mind that, if they play their cards right and put as much effort as they did into this one and the first one, then I have no doubt in my mind that the third one will be even better and be the best of the three and wrap up the trilogy in a satisfying way. So yeah, no doubt in my mind, yeah, this is my favorite movie of the year. But yeah, so I guess that does it for tonight's episode, as well as the seasons, as well as the season overall. So season 7 has come to a close. I hope you all enjoyed the season, and I will be uploading a trailer for season 8, in a few minutes. But yeah, that does it for tonight's episode. I hope you all have a great New Year's Eve and a great New Year's Day tomorrow. And I hope you all have a great week back. You know, tonight and tomorrow, well, today's Sunday, but if you have tomorrow off, enjoy your day off tomorrow. And, I will see you all, on Friday, February 2nd. I may come back a week early. I may come back on the 26th of January. But if I don't, I'll probably most likely be back on February 2nd. But and that will probably be my review of the Matthew Vaughn movie Argylle. I've been very much looking forward to that ever since the trailer came out for that. So, but yeah, so I will be posting that season 8 trailer shortly. But yeah, you guys have a great New Year's Eve, great rest of your weekend, and I'll see you all Friday, February 2nd, and for season 8. And with that being said, take care.